with public hearing on Senate Bill 542. Senator Starr?
Thank you, Chair Menace and committee members. I have brought you Senate Bill 542 at the request of Chief Crandall from the Banks Police Department. Chief Crandall is here. Would like to, if it's all right with the chair, to invite Chief Crandall to come on forward.
All right, Chief.
This bill and its introduction grew out of a specific runaway case that developed in the small community of Banks. And I would like very much to have Chief Crandall relate to you the circumstances surrounding that case and why we've brought this proposed legislation.
All right. Thank you, Senator. Chief?
Chairman, Minister, Senators, my name is Darrell Crandall, and I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Banks. I introduced this bill through Senator Starr for the purpose of not only protecting children, but also the whole family. The consequences of being a runaway not only has a bearing on the child, but on the whole family as well. The parents suffer, the grandparents, and the friends and other members of the family. Whole communities can be affected. In 1999, we had two junior high girls leave school. Through friends, they were going to run away to Seattle. Through a friend of a friend, they were able to get picked up by a 21-year-old man, be taken to another city where they were in the process of getting their hair dyed and cut, and they were going to get different clothes and a ride to the bus station in Portland. Through some fast action, we were able to pick them up at the Beaverton Mall and return them to their parents. The parents had no idea that these children were even missing from the school, let alone that they had been taken to another city for the purpose of helping them run away to Seattle. Just last week, we had another incident where a child left home, spent the weekend on the streets of Portland. Upon returning home, he stayed just long enough to clean up and then left again. He went to a suspected crack house, and when we inquired about him at that location, they lied to us. We put the house under surveillance and found the child in the front yard of the suspected drug house a short time later. He was 14. All the while, his aunt, who was a legal guardian, was worried about his whereabouts. Yet the people in the house that hid the boy were able to escape unpunished for their actions. Today, there are about 1.3 million runaway and homeless youth that live on the streets of America. One in seven kids between the ages of 10 and 18 will run away. 5,000 of these kids will die this year. That's 14 kids a day, or one kid every 1.7 hours. So by the time we get through testifying today, one child will die. In Oregon, the National Runaway Switchboard will receive almost 1,600 calls from runaways this year. The Oregon State Police state that there are 12,936 runaways in Oregon. 66% of these kids will be girls, 34% will be boys. Please note in the packet that I've had handed out, there's some other statistics in there you might want to take a look at. Some will tell you that if this bill becomes law, that the children who live on the streets won't come to the shelters for the little help that they are getting. We are not asking the shelters to apprehend runaways. We are not asking them to stop helping the runaways or the homeless youth. But a simple phone call to the police or social services will allow word to filter back to the parents and the family that at least their child is alive and well. Any social organization that deals with runaway children must not only care about the child, but the whole family as well. All this bill is asking for is a phone call to relieve some of the pain of family suffering. Under ORS 419B010, they are required to report any child that they suspect is abused. They are already mandatory reporters in that area. Under 419B007, the Legislative Assembly finds that for the purpose of facilitating the use of protective social services to prevent further abuse, safeguard and enhance the welfare of abused children, and preserve family life. And I believe the key point is preserve family life. When consistent with the protection of the child by stabilizing the family and improving parental capacity, it is necessary and in the public interest to require mandatory reports and investigations of abused children and to encourage voluntary reports. The only legitimate reason for a child to run away from home is because of abuse. The statistics say that only 8% of the children that run away do so because of abuse. If children run away from home because of abuse, they more than any need to be put in a place of safety. Not only have they already suffered a very traumatic event in their lives at the hands of an abuser, but also now they are faced with the harsh realities of life on the street. They need to get some justice, education, and some stability in their lives. As quoted from a story in the Oregonian, quoting two young runaways, "I hope people understand that most of us aren't here because we want to be," said Charlie. "If we could go home, we would." I would argue that there are some parents or family members that feel the same way about the kids. They want these kids to come home. As a government agency or private agency should try to make this happen, I don't feel a phone call is too much to ask. In keeping with the financial aspect of this in mind, I would like to remind you that the last time I talked to a prosecutor, a murder trial cost around $1 million. This is truly an ounce of prevention versus a pound of cure. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me and considering this bill.
Our chief, thank you. Any questions? No questions. Senator, thank you.
We've got
testimony both in favor and in opposition, so I'm sure this will get lively.
We have some discussions later.
Yes, we'll have
later.
Further discussions. Terry Weir.
Well, I don't know. Maybe not.
Good afternoon. My name is Terry Weiss.
Weiss. Cool.
Probably can't read my handwriting. My daughter's name is Jennifer, and I gained custody of Jennifer when she was 9 months old. And for the last 14 years, she's been raised in a very loving, caring, giving family environment. And for the last 9 years, she and I have lived with my parents. And my parents have always been a very good example for her. When the principal of the school called me up and told me that Jennifer and two other girls had walked off campus, I thought, why is she skipping school? And I told the principal I would close up my store and I would meet him at the school, which I did. And the principal informed me that occasionally some of the students would walk off campus, skip school for the afternoon, and then they would try and sneak back on campus and go into the buses when the buses came. So we waited, the buses came, the buses filled up, and the buses left. Three girls weren't there. It was at this time when I really got a sick feeling in the pit of my stomach, and it was at this time that I felt it was necessary to get Chief Crandall involved, which we did. And I went down and parked at the local supermarket, which is where they were picked up. And the parents of one of the other girls waited at a different facility. And the whole time we were waiting, the pit in my stomach got bigger and bigger and bigger. I was trying to figure out why in the world my daughter would want to run away from home. And I had no answer for that. I still, to this day, I have absolutely no knowledge of really why she wanted to run away from home. Fortunately for Jennifer and the other two girls, they were picked up by security, and I had a very long talk with my daughter afterwards. And she said something that really unsettled my nerves. I asked her, "Did you really think that you could run away from home?" And she said, "Yes." And I tried to talk to her more about it, but even to this day, she doesn't want to talk about it. So I have sought counseling services for her. Right after it happened, I sought counseling services. And she's going to get further counseling. We just signed her up for another counselor today. it's just hard for me to fathom why any child who is being raised in a non-abusive family environment, why they would want to run away from home. I will never understand that as long as I live. She is doing much better now, but the one thing that I've tried to talk to her about is trust and respect. I told her that when she ran away from home, we've had many talks about it, a lot of the trust that she had built up over the last 14 years were gone. And I told her that she would have to try hard to build up more trust, which she's been doing a pretty good job. And I told her respect is the same thing. Trust and respect should not be freely given. They should be earned. And the way that you earn trust and respect is to stay within your boundaries and limits. Keep your bedroom clean. Do this, do that. You know, very simple things. And once again, you can build up trust and respect. And like I say, she's doing a lot better now. But with the peer pressure that the kids have nowadays and the programs on TVs are just... I can understand why it's very hard for a child to not get involved with drugs, cigarettes, alcohol, sex. It's all promoted on TV. And I do censor what my daughter watches on TV. There are certain programs that I just refuse to let her watch, along with movies that I take her to and so forth. At this time, if there's any questions, I'm open for questions.
Don't have any questions. Go ahead, Senator Duncan.
I'm just curious, Mr. Chair, how would this bill be helpful to you, do you think?
Well, when I found
would
out...
Would it have been helpful to you?
When I found out that they had been picked up by somebody, an individual who was licensed to drive, I got extremely upset. If I would have come across this individual, I'm not sure what I would have done to him. In my opinion, and I will do it myself, if a child comes to me and says, I want to run away from home, I'm being abused by my father or by my mother or whoever, the first phone call I make will be the Chief Crandall. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what the individual should have done who was called up and asked for a ride. And if this bill was passed, that individual would know that if he didn't, he'd be committing a crime. So in that sense, that's what it would for me.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Kathy Osborne, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne. I'm a senior attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project is in opposition to Senate Bill 542. In my 11 years of experience of working with juveniles, there's a lot of reasons that kids run away. Abuse is one of them. Drug, alcohol abuse is another. The parents kick them out of the home and then file a runaway report. Mental health that's untreated is a big problem for the kids that are out on the street. The problem is that there's a great number of people that are more than happy to exploit the kids that run away. And the best thing that can happen to these kids that run away or are thrown out of their house is that they are able to land in places of safety with adults who slowly and surely talk to them about turning themselves in and going back home and dealing with their problems. If those people were required to call the police or SCF, the kids would not be going to those places of safety. The word would get out among kids that are out on the street that that place is not a safe place to go because they're going to turn you in, and these kids need some place to go. So they can go to, they hook up with an adult male who gives them shelter, gives them food, gives them clothes, and all of a sudden presents them with a bill for all the things that he has provided for them and puts them out on the street to prostitute themselves in order to pay, get the money to pay him back.
Kathy, do you have an actual example of a case like that?
Yes. I mean, I've had many clients where that has happened to them. For confidentiality reasons, I can't describe I can't tell you their names, but I can tell you that I've had cases where I can think of four cases right off the top of my head of young women who have told me that that has happened to them. Certainly it's when they...
That's happened, though, even with the shelters in existence now that will take them in with some degree of anonymity.
Right. But those girls, for some reason, felt that they weren't going to go to the shelters. Whether those individuals got in touch with those girls right away or before they went to the shelter or there was somebody else influencing them, those girls did not go to the shelter. Without the shelters available, however, my fear and the fear of my office is more of those girls and young boys would be in that situation.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions on that
sure.
point, because, you know, having spent 4.5 years as a child abuse detective, you know, we have gone to extraordinary lengths in the state of Oregon to try to create a system that's functional and works in a multidisciplinary environment where, you know, it's not just the law enforcement community who makes decisions about how you deal with abuse situations. It includes the medical community, the prosecutors and schools and so on and so forth, and social workers. But here you're kind of advocating for the continuation of the existing system that provides a certain amount of insulation from disclosure. Now, I'm saying that and also saying that there is a certain number of these young people who are running away who, in fact, do have abuse problems, which, you know, it's unclear to me as to whether or not these groups that would provide this protection are complying with the laws that make them mandatory reporters or not. I wouldn't have any way of knowing because it's so anonymous.
Right.
So how do you justify having a system that literally is kind of held in abeyance from the Children's Services Division, from law enforcement, from the social workers that are trained to deal with this situation, from State Office for Services to Children, Families, and other services that are available to these kids? I mean, in one sense, you're saying these kids have all of these problems, but we want to give them a little holding place that's protecting them from the police, that's protecting them from SCF because they won't cooperate, and somehow that's inherently good. And I guess I just don't understand the justification for that.
Mr. Chair, I think the justification comes when you're dealing with these kids, it's like dealing with a skittish kitten. If you run at the kitten and try to catch it, you're never going to catch it.
But
if you're able to coax the kitten
how
to
do
you,
we regulate
it works.
How do we regulate these group homes or these homes that provide these services to these children? How do we know who those people are? How do we know that they're not themselves predators or themselves qualified to work with these kids? How do we know that? It's all hidden.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the programs that I'm aware of receive money from the county and actually some from the state.
And that's supposed to give me some degree of confidence?
I think to some extent it's to give you some degree of confidence.
Well, then tell me, who is it that looks inside those programs and looks at their qualifications and does background history checks on the people that are working with these kids? And who does that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure how much the programs that work with the homeless and runaway kids do the checks on their employees. I'm sure that they do. But in terms of who regulates them, certainly recently in Portland there was the concern about whether a contract was going to be given to a program. And certainly I think those programs have come together and tried to work with the community to be to make sure that the services that they provide are services that are needed within the community, but also give both the kids the protection and give the public the knowledge that they're trying to work for the best interest of the kids and the parents. I mean, in my experience with these programs, these workers don't let the kids just come in and out willy-nilly. In my experience with the programs, these workers try to gain a relationship with the kids, talk to them about their problems, and try to convince them to either go to the police if abuse is a problem, or there's some other problem, or get in touch with SCF or get in touch with their family. An excellent example of that is the Harry's Mother program in Southeast Portland, where they actually do mediation between the parents and the child. They allow the child to stay at the program while they try to mediate the problems between the parents and the child so that the child, when the child does go home, the child stays at home. I know of other programs down in Eugene that do the same type of mediation process. Some programs...
Do they do that with some collaboration with SCF?
I know, Mr. Chair, that Harry's Mother does not have a contract with SCF. Harry's Mother receives some federal funds, actually.
They're the same ones that are located right next to the Third Eye.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Hawthorne Boulevard.
Right. Right. They've been there for
a long time.
Long time.
I always thought that was kind of an interesting contrast. Got a juvenile facility of some sort, whatever, a runaway shelter right next to a drug paraphernalia house.
I think, Mr. Chair, if the people from Harry's Mother could choose their neighbors, they probably would have, but I don't think they're able to choose their neighbors necessarily. The other problem that Juvenile Rights Project has with this bill is the broadness of the intent that's required. Basically, what it says is that the transportation, money, clothing, or shelter must be given for the purpose of helping the child run away from home. There is case law in Oregon that says that running away is like an ongoing situation. In other words, child doesn't run away, and then once they've been out on the streets for a week, they're no longer running away. They're still in the active act of running away, no matter whether they're out on the streets for a week, they're out on the streets for a month, or out on the streets for a year. They're still in the act of running away at that period of time. That would mean that, you know, somebody who comes in contact with a 14-year-old child who asks for a bus ticket so they can go home, and the person gives them a bus ticket, and that's all of a sudden, but the kid's not going to go home. That's giving them some kind of aid in terms of helping them run away. The other problem that I would have is this encompasses, say, you're the parent of a 14-year-old child, and your child's best friend comes and says, I'm running away. If you call my parents, if you call the police, if you call SCF, I'm out of here, and you know the kid's going to leave before any of those agencies or the family gets there. I'm out of there. You're not going to see me. And so as a parent, you say, okay, look, you can stay here tonight. Tomorrow we're going to call your parents. Tomorrow we're going to deal with this. I'll talk to you. You're now committing a Class C felony by trying to give that keep that child off the streets, not running away, but also giving them some ability to stay there until you can convince the child that it's better for them to deal with the problems rather than run away.
Kathy, I've got a question for you.
Sure.
And we've got some testimony that was submitted to the committee by Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition out of Eugene.
Yes.
And they're making some of the same assertions that you are here, but they're also suggesting that ORS 163-245, custodial interference, is a statute that would suffice to do what this bill intends to do, except that if you look at 163-245-1, it talks about holding the person for a permanently or for a protracted period. Now, that, if I understand correctly, creates a dilemma or a problem that law enforcement or prosecutors would have in terms of proving that the individual intended to hold the person either permanently or for a protracted period. But the question I have for you is, if you look in about the middle of sub 1, let me read it. It says, a person commits the crime of custodial interference in the second degree if, knowing or having reason to know that the person has no legal right to do so, the person takes, entices, or keeps another person from the other person's lawful custodian or in violation of a valid joint custody order. So I would agree with you that it would apply, but for the proof that the person intended to take the child or the person away permanently or for a protracted period. Because actually the existing law, but for the protracted period, really gets to the point you're trying to deal with the intent and the conduct of the person who is interfering with this child. But the question I have is the legal right or knowing you have no legal right. What legal right does one of these shelters have to interfere with the custody of a child who's run away? I mean, where is it in law that they have the authority to do what they're currently doing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my guess, I mean, I don't think, my reading of custodial interference in the second degree, the runaway and homeless programs would not fall into it, because I don't believe those programs either takes or entices in terms of keeping another.
But the question is, where is it in statute that they have a legal right to do what they're doing, i.e. hold on to a child, provide them shelter, food, clothing, so on and so forth, in absence of reporting the circumstances to the proper authorities? I mean, is there such a statute, or are we just one of those? Okay, we do have somebody shaking their head in the background here. So, Nancy, you want to share with us?
Which one? I knew it was something.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Nancy Miller, Director of the Juvenile Court Programs Division of the State Court Administrator's Office. My recollection, and I'm looking for it quickly, is that last session in the runaway bill that Representative Piercy introduced, there were temporary provisions put in 419B150. So now I need to find those.
Okay, so 419B150. Okay. But at least that will give us some guidance in terms of what the statutes say about what authority they have to do what they're doing. So.
And that bill had specific language in it that talked about the police's authority to drop these kids off at those shelters. And my recollection is there's a sunset on those temporary provisions, but it was last session or session before?
It was last session.
This
came in last session, and there's a sunset.
Okay. Because, again, as I'm reading the bill, and I co-sponsor this with Senator Starr, I don't think the intent is necessarily to get to these shelter homes, although it does raise some interesting questions about what their rights and responsibilities are in terms of reporting child abuse and so on and so forth. I'm not sure I want to go there in terms of a long, drawn-out discussion about it. I'm thinking that maybe some amendments to the custodial interference statute to deal with that protracted absence period might be helpful. So it's just kind of disclosing what I'm thinking.
But Mr. Chair, certainly Juvenile Rights Project would not be in opposition to a bill that would somehow limit it to a situation that Chief Crandall was talking about, where, you know, an adult purposely took these girls away knowing that they were running away, and was not in the business of working with homeless or runaway youth or counseling youth or dealing with that, or was not a friend that was holding the child to calm the child until the child calmed down and then they could deal with the situation. This was somebody who was actually obviously affirmatively helping the youth run away. My concern is and I've tried to figure out how you could limit it to just that class of people, and I'm not sure that you can without bringing in either the shelters or the people who are just trying to hold on to the child until the child calms down and you can figure out what's going on.
Yeah, although you know, the statute of custodial interference talks about having no legal right to do so. And I've got the language in 419B1. 65, and it does give some authority to law enforcement to drop a child off at one of these programs or a place where the juvenile court directs them to, where it reasonably appears that the child would not willingly remain at home if released to the child's parent or guardian. I think the situation we're talking about is where there's a willful intent on the part of an actor to do something that would deprive or coerce this child.
Right.
To go with them to engage in prostitution. I think you testified in some circumstances that you found yourself. So, again, I'm thinking out loud, but maybe we need a little quick work group on something like this and see if we can.
And Mr. Chair, I think the important thing is our office gets lots of calls from the, you know, parents of friends of kids who are running away, where the kids show up at their door. You know, they say, well, we want to call your parents. The kids then say, fine, I'm out of here. So the parents, you know, are calling us to say, what can we do to, you know, I don't want the kid to be back out on the street, but I want to do something here. And I think that we need to be careful in whatever amendments we do that those people are not all of a sudden committing felonies when what their intent is to get the child back to the parents, but they're trying to do the best they can without really understanding what to do.
Right, I would agree. And I think the chief would probably agree, too. I don't think you're dealing with people that are really trying to serve as an intermediary. You're probably talking about somebody that is doing something that is trying to prevent this child from, you know, getting back to their parents or whatever. So let's work on that a little bit. I've got one other person I want to... Actually, Ingrid, you've got some additional wisdom for us? Yes, no, maybe?
Yes, briefly, Mr. Chair. Ingrid Svensson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Kathy and other folks have covered the main issues. Only additional thought maybe at this point would be that if I'm understanding the chair and the witness and Senator Starr correctly, you're looking particularly at people who assist juveniles for some unlawful purpose. Would that describe...
I'm thinking of hindering prosecution or is something that they do something overt to prevent the person from being identified or...
So maybe, you know, some kind of addition to the custodial interference measure for people who assist children who are on runaway for some unlawful purpose of their own would capture that. I don't know.
Okay.
Just
sure. Senator,
I was just wondering, the conversation is going on. In some of the other things that we have dealt with in the past, prior sessions as well as recently, and some of the best interests of the child legislation we've had, and I wonder if maybe something along those lines in any work group or where you provide transportation, money, clothing, or shelter for purposes that are not in the best interest of the child. I mean, I know you have some legal things that kind of define that, so it would separate the intent of trying to help a child as opposed to trying to do something that's detrimental to them.
Chair Senator Metzger, yeah, something along those lines. That particular phrase would have a definite meaning in juvenile context, but something of that nature, I think, would probably describe it.
Right. Yeah, I think I'm thinking we can describe some elements where I think on its surface, if prosecution can prove those things in trial, that would be offensive, that any person who's reasonable would say, no, that person really shouldn't have done that, and they should be in jail, or whatever.
Perhaps not for a Class C felony, though, Mr. Chair, in all cases.
We have a tendency to like felonies around here for some reason. I don't know. We could cane them, couldn't we? Is that constitutional? No? Different country? Okay. We won't go there. Okay, Guy Miller.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Guy Miller. And like Mr. Weiss, our family is not an abusive family, but unfortunately, a year and a half ago, our daughter ran away. We live in a small community, northwestern tip of Washington County. There was no public transit, pretty much isolated. One of the girls knew somebody who knew somebody else, and they were transported out of the area, taken to some guy's apartment, and then to a shopping mall where they were picked up. Her mother and I were very worried about her safety at that time. It started to get dark, and like everybody here, when your kid's not home, she was only 13, wasn't home, and it was dark. I was almost on my knees. She's my little girl. They took my daughter, and they left her vulnerable. I think what... I listened about the shelters and stuff like that, and I know that they're good things to have out there, but these people pretty much took her out of her element, maybe with her permission, and put her in harm's way. What if they were to just abandon her? I mean, technology nowadays, you should be able to make a phone call and stuff, but my concerns are that the people who transport these kids leave them vulnerable and open to further danger, and that they should be held accountable and liable for things that may transpire, you know, after the fact of just taking them away, leaving them somewhere, and then they're, you know, there's prey, you know, they're as prey, just helpless, and then they get snatched up. You know, they take and put them in that element. Shouldn't there be some liability? mean, thank God this didn't happen to us, and but there are a lot of kids out there, and you hear about it every day on TV, that, you know, maybe if there was something so they couldn't, that they, people knew that you're not supposed to transport runaways, you know, they wouldn't just do that.
Right.
That's pretty much it.
Senator Duncan?
I'm sorry, I missed. Who were the they who took them, who took your daughter at that point?
The people that took my daughter?
Yeah.
I do not know them. The chief has got their names and stuff. But
I didn't mean by name, but I meant, were they other people your daughter's age or older people? Or?
They were older people from what I understand. And unfortunately, my daughter's a follower, not a leader, so she pretty much went. But.
So these were, Mr. Chair, these were older
kids. And
older
I,
kids.
Well, I think they were adults, actually, but isn't over 18 an adult? So they were definitely an adult.
Okay.
And I think there was like two or three of them, and then there was these three girls. So there was chances for something, you know, and knock on wood, nothing happened there. But how many times does something really happen? I mean, that's the thing that scares me. And this bill, you know, would help maybe, you know, it's like a lock keeps honest people honest, you know.
True.
It doesn't keep the dishonest person, you know, but...
Now, how's your daughter doing?
Very good.
Is she doing well now?
She's, and I like Mr. Weiss, there is a lot of peer pressure, a whole lot more than when I was a kid growing up. And, you know, it was very hard to understand why she did what she did. But, you know, she's been going through counseling. We've done love and logic classes, you know, for consequences. And, you know, but something like this, when something like this happens, there's the consequences, life or death in a lot of cases. And that's, you know, you got to... You can't overprotect your kids, but when it gets to a life or death situation, you have to, and that's why I stand behind something like this. For other people's kids, like mine, you know, she lucked out, but some don't. I drive school bus, so I love kids, but...
I'm thinking back to my mother. She said, if you ever run away from home, let me know. I'll pack your bags for you. Somehow I thought she was serious. So.
She was.
You talked to her.
That's right.
It was your wife. Or, you know.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much.
I think we'll work on some amendments to this law.
Yeah.
Mr. Travis, could we get the cooperation of you and Ingrid and company to kind of assist staff here to come up with something that... reasonable and functional. And, all right. In the best interest of children. All right. Thank you. And Mr. Mannix, could you come to testify on this fine piece of legislation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Kevin Mannix from Salem. I'm an attorney in private practice here on my own behalf. And I trust we are still on Senate Bill 542.
Yes, we are.
You've heard, I'm sure, about a variety of issues relating to this bill. I just have one issue that I wanted to present, and it's a simple one, but reflects an endemic problem in legislation, and that is a crime inflation. Should this committee decide that it wants to proceed with this legislation, I would encourage you to move out of the Class C felony category and move into the misdemeanor category, perhaps a Class A or Class B misdemeanor. If there's a desire to criminalize this conduct in some context with some limitations, you can send the message. You can establish the importance of the issue without having to make this being the equivalent of stalking. I've noticed in the last 12 years that every time we want to make a statement about something, we've tended to move into the felony category because everybody knows a felony is a very serious crime, but we forget that a Class A misdemeanor can land you in the county jail for up to a year. Class B misdemeanor can land you in the county jail for up to, I think it's 6 months and 60 days for a Class C misdemeanor. I would encourage the legislature to move more towards a gradualization as to new crimes in terms of the level of the crime. And you may be surprised to hear me say that, but actually...
We're shocked.
there's about 450 junk misdemeanors on the books, and that's another topic for another day. Things that we criminalized over the years which should have been subjected to civil penalties rather than made criminal acts. But in this case, I simply wanted to encourage consideration of movement towards the misdemeanor side of the equation rather than the felony side of the equation.
And actually, we've got a copy of Idaho's law, which is somewhat similar. It is a misdemeanor in Idaho, too. So, and I think that's a reasonable admonition. So.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask my question?
Senator Courtney.
How many junk felonies do we have?
I haven't found, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, I have not found any junk felonies. Junk misdemeanors are crimes such as failing to register as a landscape contractor. Ooh, I'm really worried about those people being out on the streets, and I think they need to be put behind bars because they're out there fixing up somebody's lawn without having registered. That is on the books. There are a number of crimes which over the years were established before we really had a comprehensive civil enforcement system where you could get a penalty out of somebody and you know, show that government meant business about regulation. But every government regulation was backed up by a crime law. And they are usually not enforced. But I think over time that they trivialized the criminal justice system by using crimes as a criminal law as a sanction. And many an honest citizen who may make a mistake could be charged with a crime and be very worried about his or her reputation. But that is another topic for another day.
Mr. Chair, I
do approach the topic with caution.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I just wondered, Mr. Chair, is the witness becoming soft on crime?
I can say...
God forbid.
Mr. Chair, I can't help but ask. I assume the county, since now we're moving towards 1145, would be very supportive of having a Class A misdemeanor. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, if you make this a Class C felony and people end up getting under 12 months, which they probably would, you'd be going through the formula as to having the state help the county pay for the residence of the felon in the county jail. If it's a Class A misdemeanor, it's a fiscal impact for the county only because they are the 100% hosts for misdemeanors. There's another problem on that side of the equation is the county jails are so full of felons that we've shoved into the counties under Senate Bill 1145 that they don't have very much room for misdemeanors. On average, about 75% of the inhabitants of the county jails now are felons, and it's worse in some counties such as Multnomah County. And there is no room at the inn for misdemeanors, or there's very limited amount of room at the inn, and the real sanctions for misdemeanors have gone down as a result. That is another problem.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Any other questions, comments? Anybody else feeling compelled to testify? If not, we'll close the public hearing. Senate Bill 542. And let me see. Who's our next victim?
Okay. Work session on Senate Bill 406. I don't know what the hell that was all about. I mean, I can't help but give his position on 1145. I can't believe I just
had to call him in here, buddy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Senate Bill 406. We had a public hearing on this bill a long time ago. And this is the Private Investigators Board. Now the chair has exercised his prerogative as a chair to the extent that you'll support me in this, which is contested. Dealing with the Board of Investigators, one of the issues that came out of the public testimony by Mr. Henson was that for whatever reason, the Board of Investigators has construed the law to require that investigators working under the direction of a person practicing law would have to be a licensed investigator. I personally found that somewhat objectionable since they have bar rules that require them to you know, give direction and guidance to people working under their authority as a member of the bar. So we have the dash four amendments in front of us that would, counsel, in essence.
In essence, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the dash four amendments would do away, if you look at the original bill, 406, would do away with the amendment that's in the bill.
Called the gut stuff.
Right. And then what it would do is it would do two things, really. It would clarify that an attorney or an agent of an attorney, which is specifically the situation that the chair has talked about, is not accepted from having to be licensed under the Board of Investigators. And the portion that deals with that is on page 2, line 2, where there's an addition on, this is the dash four amendments that says, or an agent of the attorney. Then on subsection 9, on page 2, line 3 of the dash 4 amendments, make sure that you have it. That changes the language. It says a legal assistance or paralegal to any person employed by an attorney admitted to practice law in the state engaged in activity for which the person is employed. So the idea of those two amendments is to exempt a investigator who works for the district attorney's office or the public defender's office, but works for one employer or works for one attorney, that person does not need to be licensed by the board. The other thing that the amendments do is on page 2, line 29, one of the, we heard testimony about an operative is basically as I recall, is someone who works for the investigator, and it just says an operative is subject to the ethical and legal requirements of the investigator under whose direction and control the operative works. That's the other change. So it adds that requirement that an operative working with an investigator follow the ethical and legal requirements of the investigator's employer. So if the investigator is working with an attorney, then the investigator and the operative must follow those ethical and legal requirements.
And just for the committee, if you'll recall, we had some testimony from Mr. Hansen that he spends about $25,000, I think, a year. Biennium?
For biennium, about
$45,000 a biennium of general fund money out of the end of defense dollars available to his agency to license these people. These amendments would basically take that requirement away and hence save $45,000 in general fund monies in the biennium. So with the committee's indulgence, I would appreciate a motion to adopt the dash four amendments unless somebody's went to the actual original language.
Chair, I move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 406.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of Dash 4 Amendments to Senate Bill 406. Discussion. And Senator, did you have a comment? Or?
Yeah, actually, I just had a question. The 2 and 3 amendments are out of play.
Well, originally I wanted to wipe out the entire agency because if you know the history of this thing, just so as you know, in 1997, when I chaired Judiciary, there was a bill in my committee that I sat on because I didn't think that we needed another state agency to govern investigators. In the closing moments of the 97 session, as most people would call, is frenzied, and it ended up being adopted through the Rules Committee in a last-minute amendment to some bill, and was enacted through a very surreptitious process, in my opinion. And I think it's created a lot of problems, particularly amongst professional investigators. So there's an argument on one side that says we should have a governing board that gives us professional standards and professionalization, so on and so forth, yet their fees for being part of this organization are about $500 a year plus a certain kind of insurance that they have to carry and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of consternation out there. What I'm intending to do, because we do have some other vehicles dealing with this agency, is to get some folks together and see if we can't come up with some amendments to the actual operation of the agency to make it a more functional agency that works in the interest of licensed investigators. So
the Bash 2 would certainly go a long way toward that.
Well, we can always adopt those for another one, and it'll just clarify the whole problem later. But. Okay, so we have a motion then for the Dash 4. Is there any objection to Dash 4 at this time? No? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill 406
as amended
to the Senate
floor
with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Courtney moves the Senate Bill 406 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. It's ordered. And anybody want to carry this number? I'll do it. Okay, Senator, would you do it? Okay. Thank you. Senator Burdick will carry it. And next up, let's see. Okay, Diane Middle, Senate Bill 291, Public Hearing. And assuming, Diane, you're first up since you're the agency director. Weren't you just honored today for being a wonderful person or something?
I missed that one.
Senator Courtney.
She was in the Senate.
I think I should explain it because I think what you're referring to is a statement that I know we read and spoke from regarding the fact that she's one of them. Not given honored by the commission or an odd living for a special achievement they have so designated in the last 16 years. And so I made that statement on the Senate floor. This is Women's History Month, and then I proceeded to read as well as verbalize from the state status. But I thank you, Congressman. I do not believe that she was in vicinity at the time I did that remarkable thing. And
self-proclaimed.
I did a wonderful performance on my part, and that's why you're thinking what you're thinking.
Well, I thought so, but I thought you could use a little bit more voice inflection and syntax.
It's true. I was
very kind of monotone.
I truly was. I was very so.
And I don't think that really represents Diane Nettles' career at all.
Mr. Chair, were you aware you were so honored today?
I was not, and I am very pleased, and I thank you very much for that, and I will call it up on the Internet and listen to it.
You were also honored, by the way, in the House of Representatives. I did also hear that. So.
Thank you very much.
You might want to get the tapes of those.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I will. Thank you very much.
Would you please take this bill
now? Thank you. Chair Mittis and members of the committee, I am Diane Middle, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and I'm here today to provide some information to you on Senate Bill 291. Also present today in the hearing room, should you have any questions on this bill, are Joan Davies, the supervisor of our private security unit at DPSST, Harold Burke Sivers, who works with the Salem-Keizer School District providing school security, Eric Myers, who owns EBM Security out of Medford, James DiLoretto, who owns Starplex Security and Crowd Management Services out of Portland, and Corwin Noble, who's with Noble Limited, also out of the Portland area. This is a housekeeping bill. As you recall, private security became under the purview of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training back in 1995. What we observed is that under the current ORSs, they presently disqualify from certification or licensure for a 10-year period of time individuals who have been convicted of violating any law involving the possession or delivery or manufacture of controlled substances. What this bill will do is change that wording to allow it to be that the disqualifiers would be for felonies or misdemeanors, thus preventing the situation where a person who was convicted of possessing merely less than an ounce of marijuana could not be licensed for a 10-year period of time. So it makes that change. The other thing it does is recognize as part of how the training occurs. In the statute, it refers to the second portion of training, which is the demonstrated portion, as being called on-the-job training. The reality is, for private security, they do not have to be hired prior to getting the training. So it would not technically be on-the-job training. And what this does is retitles it as the assessment module. It doesn't change the training at all, just gives it a proper term since the employment is not required. The other thing it does is both armed and unarmed private security officers are required to renew certification every 2 years. And this particular alters the bill for unarmed refresher training requiring both armed and unarmed officers annually every 2 years. When this bill was drafted, there was inadvertently an error made in this, and it made armed officers also only do their firearms recertification every 2 years as well, and that should continue to be annually. So the regular refresher courses for both unarmed and armed should be every 2 years, but armed is still required to do the actual firearms portion of it every year. The other amendment that we would ask for at this time also would be, we noticed that the bill allowed an armed private security officer to receive their certification as young as 18 years of age. That was an inadvertent oversight. The practice has been that they not receive that certification until 21 years of age, the same as law enforcement officers. And we would just ask that that be amended to reflect not only the current practice, but what would be considered a best or better practice, that they not receive that till at least 21 years of age. There is no one currently certified as an armed officer under 21 years of age, so it would have no impact. To my knowledge, this bill has no fiscal impact, and I'm not aware of any opposition.
Where would the amendment be? Is it line 7?
If I handed you these, it would have been much easier.
Do you have LC amendments?
I do not. What I do, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on the back of the testimony which I'm handing you, it suggests
after the solid line there, the amendments that would be necessary, indicating page 3, lines 12 and 13 and 15 and 16 would take care of the armed, unarmed training, and then page 1, line 7 would take care of the 21 years.
Okay, all of the other interested parties, come forward, please.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
You can ask a question, yes,
of course. Dan, I wanted to clarify for the record. You said that the current bill is 18, but it's actually the current statute is 18, correct?
Yes, I did mean to say statute. Thank you for that correction.
All right. Interested parties? Mr. Meyer, Davies, Severs, DeLoretto, excuse me, and Noble, all of y'all? Come on. I'm going to get you all on record saying you love this thing. That's what I'm going to do. Because I was told this is a consensus bill, and it better be. Harold, you were in my office yesterday and told me everybody loved this thing. Is that true?
Senator Mittis, members of the committee, that is correct.
That
for the record.
The amendments that Ms. Middle just...
That's correct.
All right. Anybody have any opposing opinions?
No, Mr. Chairman. I thank all of us here very much in support and back what Ms. Middle testified to today.
All right. Sir?
What it's looking at is clarifying a lot of the different statutes and doing more house cleaning on the statute.
All right. Thank you. Senator Burdick.
Who are these people?
Well, that's right. We should actually ask have you introduce yourself. Thank you, Senator Burdick.
You're welcome.
I'm Harold Burke Sivers. I'm the security coordinator for the Salem-Keizer School District, and I also serve as governmental entity representative for the Private Security Advisory Committee.
I'm James J. DeLoretto. I'm president of Starplex Corporation and Crowd Management Services.
I'm Corwin Noble. I'm the president of Noble Limited, and I am a member of the Public Security Advisory Committee representing the arms sector of the industry.
All right. Thank you. And Joan Davies, the lady seated to the right of Ms. Middle. And you don't have an opposing opinion, do you? You're on board. All right. Good. And let me see. Who else do we have? Mr. Meyer.
Eric Meyer with UPM Security. I'm Bedford, Oregon, private security company owner.
Okay. And you love this thing too, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, good. Thank you very much. Now that I have you on the record, I'll hold you this forever and ever and ever. Okay, I don't know that I want to do the conceptual amendment deal on this. I think we'll have these things LC drafted and bring it back quickly. Anybody else feel compelled to testify on this Hummer? No? Close public hearing then. And public hearing on Senate Bill 494. All right, this is the Kathy and Ingrid show. Come on up here and tell me why you hate this thing. Since this was my idea.
We were going to ask about that. Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And Kathy Osborne.
Kathy Osborne, senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project.
And Your Honor, President, I've been in court this morning. Mr. Chair and members, we do oppose this measure. Currently, kids are held longer than 36 hours, despite the fact that adults may not be held longer than 36 hours without a judicial determination of probable cause to detain them. And the current law allows that if, for example, a youth is arrested on a Friday night and taken into custody, the current law does not require that a court determine before Monday sometime whether there's probable cause for that arrest or detention. And I think the practice varies from one county to another. In Multnomah County, the court basically does not agree that the constitutional provisions applicable to adults apply to juveniles. So They continue to hold kids without judicial determinations over the weekends and holidays. But beyond the status of the current law, this measure would actually increase the period of time for which youths could be held without that judicial determination. And I wasn't actually sure why that might be advisable, but we would oppose it. And in fact, Mr. Chair, this bill might be a good opportunity to correct the current problem in the law, and that could be done by just deleting the language excluding Saturdays, Sundays, and judicial holidays, and that would accomplish a good thing, bringing juvenile treatment into conformity with adult treatment.
All right. Kathy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, my name is Kathy Osborne, senior attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project is also opposed to this. Ingrid is somewhat correct. I'm sorry to have to be the one to tell her that she's incorrect, however, in one aspect. In 1991, the United States Supreme Court decided the case of County of Riverside versus McLaughlin, which is found at 500 U.S. 44. In that case, what the U.S. Supreme Court said is that when an adult is arrested, a probable cause hearing must be held within 48 hours, and that has to include holidays and weekends. That there is no exclusion, but it's not the 36 hours that Ingrid previously told you. The Supreme Court seems to think that 48 hours is appropriate. What the Supreme Court said in that case is 48 hours is not always constitutionally permissive. If the state could do it or the county could do it faster, could do a probable cause hearing faster, but 48 hours isn't always unconstitutionally, it's not always unconstitutional if there was some reason for the delay, but that's on an individual case. In terms of this case, in this bill, in terms of increasing the number to 48 hours with excluding the Saturdays, Sundays, and judicial holidays, that would mean that a youth who's picked up on a Friday morning before, or let's say the Wednesday before Thanksgiving would be then a legal holiday. Friday was not a legal holiday, but there's 24 hours. Then Saturday and Sunday would go by, and Monday would go by, and then you have 48 hours, and the probable cause determination does not need to happen until the Tuesday following that arrest on a Wednesday. And what the probable cause determination is it's to make sure that there is enough evidence to hold the youth, and it's not the arrest is essentially lawful at that point, or the hold is lawful at that point. That would mean that a youth could stay in detention for that period of time. We don't have, many counties have a shortage, actually, of detention beds. And I think that I've heard many juvenile directors say over and over again that one of the best deterrents for juveniles is not a filled detention bed, but an empty detention bed. Before Multnomah County started their detention reform, we were constantly hitting our capacity on detention and releasing kids from detention, especially on weekends, because we were over capacity. That would mean that kids that could come in wouldn't be held, or kids that were ordered would leave early. When kids know that they're going to be held for a period of time, that's significant for them. To increase it from 36 to 48 hours, my concern is that's essentially taking up a bed that somebody else might be able to use that would be more beneficial for the person that is being kept out of the bed. The reality is, if you give the counties 48 hours to do this, they'll take 48 hours to do it. If you give them 72 hours to do this, they'll take 72 hours to do it. If you give them 12 hours to do it, they'll do it in 12 hours. That's the reality of the situation, and I think that right now what we have is, at least in terms of ORS 419C170 and ORS 419C139, those don't comply with the U.S. Supreme Court's determination in the County of Riverside versus McLaughlin. I'll let the committee know that they rest that on the Fourth Amendment, and the Fourth Amendment has been applied to juveniles. So I think that the determination by the Multnomah County courts that the constitutional provisions that this that Riverside rests on don't apply to juveniles is incorrect. But I think that certainly if this committee wants to do something about this statute, the way to do it, you could change it to 48 hours, but then omit the excluding Saturdays, Sundays, and judicial holidays, and that would bring it within constitutional guidelines, and you would have the 48 hours.
And Mr. Chair, members, I apologize. I appreciate Kathy reminding me that it had been some time since I read Riverside, but I think that is correct.
Well, how are we doing it now as adults? Because I know when I've arrested people on a Friday, we have to do a probable cause affidavit that's filled out in addition, and oftentimes you staple your reports to the affidavit, and a judge reviews it at some point. But I'm unclear as to when the judge reviews the affidavit.
And forgive me, I've forgotten that as well, Mr. Chair.
But, Kathy, what you're saying is the Riverside case more likely than not does apply to juveniles based on the Fourth Amendment hinge, is what you're...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've certainly had that argument with Judge Welsh, yes.
You didn't win.
No.
Well, could I add, Mr. Chair, with respect to that, there are occasions when we have had circuit court judges in Multnomah County grant writs of habeas corpus because the youth have not had the constitutional hearing, so not all of the judges would agree. Unfortunately, there's generally no remedy by the time you get to court to argue the habeas corpus, then the court can rule on the whole, so it really doesn't accomplish much.
Although I'm thinking in terms of procedure, I don't know, it doesn't seem to me that it would be offensive for law enforcement to do probable cause affidavits for juveniles. Although I don't know how that applies to certain status offenses, and currently it's not applied, it doesn't function that way, but there's no real reason why law enforcement wouldn't want to do that, I don't think. Although I do know it's been a long time since I've actually lodged a juvenile. In fact, it's been 10 years since I've been a uniformed police officer, but they did require copies of all of our police reports before we ever left the building, and they were pretty adamant about that. So I'm assuming that those reports being on file might have supported probable cause, assuming that the arrest was valid.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, all yours were. Well, most of them that I know. Questions? Concerns? Issues? Anybody want to testify on this, Hummer? Nope. Notice relating clause? We're adjourned. Thank you.